the secret of quality improvement, at least from what I can see over time, is it does take a multitude of efforts by a multitude of people to move our biggest problems.
I'm Christiana Facey Crowther, and I'll be your nurse. It's the new decade and the year of clear vision. 2020. The holidays just ended, and that can be a time in the hospital, depending on where you're located, when the intensity dial just turns up even more. For us, it was a holiday season with high acuity, high demand for beds. For some people, it's a really tough time of year. For others, the holidays just turn up that hope and pressure to get well and get home. And so when a bad outcome or a system failure or inefficiency happens and we can't meet patients' needs, it just feels extra hard for everybody. And you notice the gaps even just a bit more where we as a system fall short. This year also marks 20 years since the release of the Joint Commission's landmark report, To Err is Human, which first quantified in the U.S. the prevalence and impact of medical error. We're still humans providing healthcare, for now anyway, and we as individuals, collectives, systems are still making errors. Now, quantifying the actual magnitude of the problem is still a hot debate. Are medical errors truly the third leading cause of death in the U.S.? How much of that is actually preventable? Is it really true that 1 in 18 hospital stays in Canada involves some kind of serious error? Does this represent a gross underestimation, as some people claim? I don't know. But I do know from my own experience that harms happen. They happen where I work, in the teams I work with, under my watch sometimes. Some of it is preventable. And I'm going to say quite confidently that that is the case where you work too. So how should we be thinking about this? What kinds of solutions actually exist to address these problems? What is the scope of the problem? What elements fall under the responsibility of the individual clinician, the unit, the organization? What rests with policymakers? Because while progress has been made in some areas, new challenges are constantly arising. How do we start establishing the systems or adopt the kinds of behaviors that are necessary so that we can more readily adapt? Because we need to. Because we really cannot keep going like this. It's just so costly to everybody. So what can we do? Because if not us, then who? So to start to explore this topic, I speak here with Lily Yang. Lily, as you will see, has been involved with quality work since it became a thing. I met with her in her office in the renovated Dawn Jail, which was historically one of Toronto's most notorious prisons and now houses the administration of a state-of-the-art, publicly funded rehab facility and hub for patient-centered healthcare innovation. And if that's not a sign that change is possible and inevitable, I really don't know what is. Speaking of quality, it's sort of ironic that on this one, I messed up my microphone and had to use the room mics. So the sound is a bit not great, but Lily is wonderful and wise and practical. So please forgive my errors. I'm human after all. And welcome, Lily Yang.
Are you a nurse?
No, I'm a respiratory therapist by background.
Oh, you are.
Super fun.
So how did you get
from a respiratory therapist attending codes
to
this?
This office in this prison.
In this prison, yes.
This former prison.
I like to think I work in a loft-like environment here. So I actually was a respiratory therapist and worked in both acute care and in rehab and moved on to being a practice leader. So I was a respiratory therapy professional practice leader, and somebody said to me, hey, there's this patient safety coordinator secondment. Do you want to try it? And I said, what is this patient safety coordinator secondment, given there's nobody who historically ever had that role of patient safety coordinator way back when, before the time of CPSI and all the Canadian Patient Safety Institute and all of that. Yes, I am that old. So before
experience,
all of experienced, I am that experience. That's right. Somebody said, hey, Accreditation Canada came out with these required organizational practices, and we need someone to ensure that the organization has these things in place. And so it was all about patient safety. So that's how all of this world started.
And so how long has this been your professional focus now?
Well, funny enough, from that secondment, I went on to do multiple other secondments. Then I went into operations. So I kind of did a lateral move over because I could never understand how come things are always so hard to in operations. And the theoretical idea of all these things that could improve were so clear in the world of quality and patient safety, but so often hard to do. So off I went into operations. So your question of how long has this been a focus, even though I was an operations manager, and as it should be the case, quality has been the focus probably at least for a decade and a half.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And operations, specifically, that means like...
So I managed stroke, I managed spinal cord injury, I've managed inpatients, I've managed outpatients. Outpatients have included everything in the rehab side, from seating clinics, feeding clinics, to urology clinics, to, again, from an inpatient end, all of the typical things that happen on a stroke unit. It actually had an acquired brain injury unit as well.
So really working with changing practices that interface with the patient and family, like
so
directly.
Operations is sort of that frontline management of a unit or a team with all the multiple responsibilities, I'll just say, that happen in operations. And then I was given this wonderful opportunity to come back to quality. So after sort of a 5-year hiatus in operations, I had the opportunity to come into the role of director of quality and just recently became the senior director of quality and patient experience.
I think quality can be, as you said, it can mean a lot of things depending on the environment that you're in.
Yeah.
But when you think about entering an environment and thinking about what is quality, very simply, like what does Lily Yang say? What is quality?
Quality exists everywhere, as you and I both know. So if I say to you, what's your favorite restaurant? What's your favorite restaurant?
It's a roti place in my neighborhood.
Okay, yeah. Roti place in your neighborhood. What makes it great? Why is this your favorite restaurant?
It has delicious food, not a long wait. My whole family likes it. It's healthy. I feel good after it. The service is nice. It's local.
Okay. You have just described quality in all of its many dimensions. So you have said to me it's effective in delivering the food you want because it's delicious, as you said. Your whole family loves it. It's great service. So that end of customer service or patient family centered. And so when we think about restaurants, I'll give you a fun example because, of course, I went to a restaurant and started chewing on salad. And as I was chewing on salad, something got really crunchy. And I thought, lettuce, must be the lettuce, except it wouldn't actually finish crunching. And then I spit it out, and what was it but broken glass? Because they had broken a bowl in the dishwasher, and it ended up in my salad. So from a safety end, when I go to a restaurant, I neither want to eat glass, nor do I want to have food poisoning. And so similarly, when we think about quality at its very minimum levels, we want to be safe. I don't want to be hurt when I go into a hospital. I'm already in one of my most vulnerable times. The last thing I need is an infection that I wasn't supposed to have. The last thing I need is a pressure injury that I wasn't supposed to have. All of these things are sort of the elements of safety when we look at that dimension of quality. Nobody wants to get a diagnostic result that's really scary and then have to wait a ridiculous amount of time to have the surgery. After a devastating event, nobody wants to have had a stroke and take a very long time to get into a rehab program. So all of these things are about quality when we say, look, we want to be able to meet the specifications of what the person needs. And so when we think about healthcare, all of those dimensions make perfect sense. I want to be safe. I need it to be timely. I need you to be effective, right? So if you're going to treat me, I would hope you're going to use best practice to the best knowledge that we have to give me the care that I need. We need it to be patient-centered. Again, I've said people are in their most vulnerable times, right? So the last thing anybody needs is to have care that isn't sensitive to what they need and kind. It's really just even that simple. It's about, obviously, the technical definition of information sharing, respect, dignity, partnership, collaboration. All of those are important words. But at the end of the day, it's recognizing this is somebody's mother, father, son, brother, sister, wife, child, who's in your care. And so it's our opportunity there. Of course, we need to be efficient, and of course, we need to be equitable. Those are all the dimensions of quality. So we want the best outcome with the least cost possible because we have to treat lots of people with a limited amount of dollars. And so the more efficient we can be while delivering great care, the better it is.
Which I like to return to what you said before when you were in the quality world and sort of wondering, like, it seems so clear.
Yes.
And us as care providers at the bedside, we all theoretically want to be participating in that process too. And yet, you know, when I go, if you were to take me into a unit and put a blindfold over my eyes and spin me around and then I just stopped and pointed at something, the majority of the people who work in that environment would probably look at that thing and be like, yeah, we can improve that. Like, whatever process it attaches to or whatever thing in the environment it is.
Yeah.
So how do you help, in your role, people who work in these places prioritize what to focus on?
Yeah, and so here at Sinai Health System, we have these quality aims. And what we've done is tried to really focus using the data, so using the information we have, and said, okay, where, if we were to analyze sort of the biggest areas where we have the most opportunity to improve, because you're right, you can improve every single thing, and I could all day be improving, and I feel like that's my whole life all the time anyways, but you have to understand that quality is a team sport. It isn't, it's almost never one person is going to be able to deliver a quality. And so when we look at,
Or even one discipline,
there's no, it is a team sport because healthcare is a team sport. And so it's recognizing that everybody needs to be involved in it. And so if you're doing one thing and somebody else is doing something else and somebody else is doing something else and you're all making improvements, you're all kind of making small improvements, that's fantastic. But what the secret of quality improvement, at least from what I can see over time, is it does take a multitude of efforts by a multitude of people to move our biggest problems. It's easy to move some of the smallest things. If I said to you, gosh, that door handle is broken, we can get that fixed tomorrow immediately. But if I told you that systematically we have a whole lot of problems related to infection, it's not about one person fixing the infection. It could be about antimicrobial stewardship. It could be about environmental cleaning. It could be around anything from catheterization practices, right? So there's a whole lot of people who have to be working to best practice in order for us to eliminate things like healthcare-associated infections. It's not just your job.
Mm-hmm. It seems that, it's that coordination.
Yeah.
That is,
that's where all the plans come in.
Yeah, the planning.
You choose
a topic that makes sense.
Yep.
And then everybody thinks, okay, yes, on a sort of a basic level, I understand that this is something that I can see the impact of this, and I understand the impact of this. And it seems that, you know, building meaning amongst the team and getting everyone to sort of shift attention towards that in an environment where your attention is claimed by so many things.
Yeah.
It seems that in my experience, that step of sort of getting everyone involved and making a good, solid plan that everyone knows and is committed to, that's one of the first sticking points, it seems.
Well, that's where those structures are so important, and that's where you're seeing things like unit councils are getting revitalized. We're bringing in quality triads into the organization where there's actually leadership at local team levels. And then you've got that data end, right? And the overall strategy and the aim. So if I said, hey, Unit 14 North. Mm-hmm. Your biggest issue is when we look at our overall aims, we see that C. difficile is one of your biggest issues. Mm-hmm. But maybe your patient experience scores are fantastic. Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. Then the team has the ability to say, what am I going to work on here? I might be able to say, you know what? C. difficile and pressure injuries are both pretty ugly on our unit, but we've got it going on really well around the slips and falls and things like that that are happening. That's great. What happens is then that unit council, the business units, the team, and that triad needs to come together and say, well, what specifically is going on here? And that's when you've got the opportunity to do things like the root cause analysis. Like, we already have major sort of driver diagrams to tell us. If I was talking about C. difficile, listen, we know there's best practices in antimicrobial stewardship. You might find out, you know what, our prescription practices aren't meeting best practice. That's the thing we're going to work on. Then that's the thing you work on. If you say from a pressure injury perspective, nobody's getting turned, nobody's getting mobilized, and that's actually what's causing from best practice, knowing what the evidence says, you know what, we kind of don't apply the evidence. So what can we do to be different? And so then we come up with something that says, all right, fine. You know what, if it's pressure injuries, we are just going to start with the best practice related to nutritional intake so that they have wound healing. Then that's great. Then maybe every patient that has whatever criteria will need the appropriate nutritional analysis done. And so there's a dietitian involved, there's a nurse involved, there's a physician involved, the kitchen might be involved, whatever. And the patient and the family, of course. Mm-hmm. Right? So that's that end of everything, depending on what the thing is going to require a bit of a team to say, how are we going to do it differently?
It seems that there's quite a body of evidence growing around how individuals and teams and organizations can approach these kinds of real change management processes.
Yep.
And so do you engage with that a lot? Is that how you sort of structure what you do?
Yeah, so we certainly are influenced heavily through the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, mm-hmm. Health Quality Ontario, the Canadian Patient Safety Institute. We've had mentor organizations. A group of senior leaders actually recently had just gone to Florida and had an opportunity to see another organization that is a top performer. And so some of those structures that we're talking about, like the triads, because it gets really concrete then, right? What are you even talking about? We're talking about a unit council lead, a physician lead, an administrative lead.
So that's what you're planning to sort of
that's
start
a plan
in
that's
your organization?
In our organization, yeah, to build the capacity for quality improvement. So you're absolutely right. People need the skills, but you need to give the people who have the ability to remove all the barriers and lead in some of those challenging sort of situations. So we need to build capacity, but we also have to create the structures.
I'm just going to interrupt to offer a quick summary. So quality care relies on teamwork, on structures and coordinated efforts that involve everybody, on good open communication, sufficient time set aside to actually plan and support the efforts necessary to change a complex system. Time that does not exist during the hours that we provide patient care. That is just not a sufficient enough amount of time to do this kind of work. And that really resonates with my own experience of practice change at the local level. So I next asked Lily, how do we address the challenge of engaging staff and patients in the planning process?
There's a few challenges. There's number one, getting the data to the front line because they're hugely insightful and they'll absolutely be able to tell you, well, yeah, sure, part of our problem around this, and it's actually patients and families. So bringing it both to patients and families, to them in co-design efforts to say, if this is our problem, where do we think is the greatest emphasis that needs to happen here to make the biggest change in what's going on? So if we talk about patient experience and say our lowest scores, which historically are always our lowest scores, are around continuity and transitions, it's around information sharing, something as simple as information sharing. if I asked our frontline staff, where are the moments when we share information? And if this was it could be any team, right? It could be a surgical team. And we say, well, where are the points where information is shared? Oftentimes they'll tell you, sometimes it's verbal, sometimes they have no idea where the brochures are, but we do have one. And, you know, there's various places. I'm also a surveyor for Accreditation Canada, so I get the great chance of seeing organizations across Canada give me exactly that answer. And so when you say, where are those points, a lot of times it's not intentional. And so intentionality is a huge part of quality. So if I said I want to change my experience metric related to how we share information and how people receive information, we have so many things to factor in, but it goes right down to the basic level of what's your process. So if we have no process, it begins with you better actually come to a process so that we can improve on that process. If at the end of the day you said to me, listen, I give information on day one, day three, and day five right before they go home, fantastic. Then at least I know you know that it's day one, day three, and day five. Then we can have the conversation that says, well, maybe the information's not in the right language. Maybe the information's not incorporating health literacy. Maybe the information is in tiny print. I have no idea what's wrong with the information, or maybe the way it's delivered isn't the right way. Maybe it should be a podcast and not a brochure. Or maybe there's no brochure at all, and it's just verbal each time. But oftentimes what we find is there's no day one, day three, day five. And oftentimes we'll find there's no brochure or that everybody actually, I can't find 90% of the staff or 80% of the staff knowing what is this path.
Yeah.
So when we say, why is this so confusing that the information score is so low? Is it that the patient didn't understand anything, or is it that we have no process to provide anything? So that's sort of that analysis that needs to happen, and it has to happen in combination with the patient, because one of the really good co-design events we had was with patients with brain injuries. And what we found out was we were trying to distribute our patient-oriented discharge summary, and the team had the idea that, sure, we could provide it all on that last day, which is not completely not typical, that we think we'll provide you with the discharge information on the last day because medications change, we were told, and so, you know, you have to finalize the prescription on the last day and things like that. And of course, the person with the brain injury in our groups, the couple of patients said, that's ridiculous. We can't absorb all of that, and I can't ask you anything if you do that, so can you back that up a couple of days so that you give us the time, even if it's a few disciplines each day, and then you're able to absorb and ask questions over that time, because really it turned out only the medications were the things that really made huge changes. And so that was probably the only thing that had to be finalized on the last day. And in fact, you could have 90% of the conversation earlier and maybe only one med was going to change. So once you got right down to it, it was a lot clearer. But then also from the patient's perspective, the question was as simple as, what do you do if, when you get home? And so what do I do if, we, from the healthcare provider side, had everything from, well, what do you do if your blood pressure is high? What do you do if XYZ happens? And the patient's question was actually quite simple, is, what do I do if I have a headache? Do I go to an emergency room at this point if I have another serious headache? Do I call 911? Am I going to my family doctor? Do I just take some Tylenol? So that was a very reasonable question after somebody's had a serious, you know, brain aneurysm. And yeah, that's fair. Good question. And so I think the importance of partnering with patients and families to understand what's their perspective, what do they need from us, and knowing that one or two will not necessarily be representative of everybody, but it's one or two more voices as you design something than you would have had. And so those are the opportunities that we have to change systems. So if I say your information score is low, how do you bring a group of people together to say, what are the things we need to do to change so that I have a day one, three, and five, and then I know the material we think on first go we're going to make reliable, and then we have the opportunity, if your score goes up a little bit but not where you thought, to go back again and say, well, what more do we need to do? well, the more might be we needed a podcast, or maybe we needed the information available online so that after they've gotten home, they have a chance to refer to it again. Or maybe we actually had to do teach back so that we actually realized that the person understood. And one of the things I learned was we often have checklists that we sign off to say, yes, I taught this, yes, I taught this, yes, I taught this, as opposed to, yes, I understand this, yes, I understand this, yes, I understand. So it's kind of a, again, how do we bring the individual into the bedside?
And how then do we take that learning and bring it to, and loop it in, return it to the providers, and then listen to what they
That's
have
right.
to say about the process
That's
as
right.
well.
Yeah.
And all of that, I think it just continues to reinforce that all of that really does require time,
yes,
focus, and energy. But I imagine that once you start to take, like, I could see a big hurdle sort of the first time you go through that process.
That's right.
But theoretically, hopefully over time.
Here's the good news.
Okay.
Here's the good
news. I want
news.
Some.
Here's the good news. The good news is when I get the chance to survey organizations who, of course, do a lot of work to prep, and of course we see the best of everybody, organizations have in Canada, have a really good basis to begin with. It's not almost like we're starting from nothing with anything. So even if I said to you, what's the information we share about this particular surgical procedure, even if we don't have day one, day three, day five set up, what we have is evidence to tell me how we should educate people. We have so many ridiculously good resources available that you do not have to create anything from scratch, pretty much, because someone in the most common of surgeries and the most common of procedures have created all of these tools, probably podcasts, in addition to translated materials, in addition to brochures. It's really a question of the team having to come together to just say, well, how are we going to do it on our unit?
It's that part.
Yeah.
It's the part of the interruption of business as usual to bring everyone into one place to collaborate.
Yeah. And that's the part where the culture shift has to occur, where it's just the way we do things. We're always looking at how do we make those improvements happen. It's about setting up the structures like a unit council where the intentional focus is having the conversation that says, well, this is what's happening. How can we think about making this improvement happen? It's about having the professional practice structures so that knowledge translation can happen, because as you said, good gosh, the evidence changes continuously. Mm-hmm. Good news, research is continuously happening, and we're getting better and better at being able to treat people. We just need to adopt those practices, right? So we've got lots of structures in place. The question is just how do we fully mobilize it? What we were able to see in Florida that was a lot of fun was they also managed to incorporate that novice clinician all the way to the most expert clinicians at the front line. And so the most novice clinician, as part of their performance appraisal even, on a yearly basis, would have to complete a number of tasks. And the tasks might be as simple as you need to do 5 chart audits related to catheterization of patients or antimicrobial use, because we also know that data at this point is still a little bit manual and not fully electronic. So that's going to help too. Technology is going to help a lot.
Hope so.
But we're in the bumpy phase. But for now, there's still a lot of manual collection that needs to happen. Mm-hmm. And so can we assign some sort of task that says, have that person be able to do those audits, meet those 5, understand how they've contributed to quality improvement, and assign that role. As you keep moving further up, somebody who's a little bit more experienced might be able to take a look at those audit results.
So it's kind of like an apprenticeship model into quality improvement.
You got it. And then the most senior of folks might be the unit council leads. They might be the folks that are leading within those triads, and more skills are added around how do you read these things? How do you look at, you know, these run charts or these control charts, or how do you set this thing up, or what are we doing with this Pareto diagram or this driver diagram? What are we doing with all these things?
I don't even know what you're saying. I know it's English.
It's mumbo-jumbo. But how do we analyze better and figure out what are the things we need to be working on here? But the some of that gets a little convoluted from my perspective, because at the end of the day, if I told you your experience score with information sharing is 30%, 30% over the last 5 to 10 years of people say, hey, we got enough information on discharge, it probably doesn't matter how far we go in this analysis. If I just asked you, how do we make an increment of improvement? This isn't rocket science, yeah. Right? So that's the part where it's just intentionality now, and it's not rocket science anymore.
I think that intentionality part.
There's this whole concept around joy in work, right? And so that's the thing in quality improvement that says, well, how do we motivate people? And how do we get that discretionary effort to occur? Mm-hmm. And in healthcare, we have this real luxury of the fact that what matters is right in front of you,
yeah,
almost always, right? So if I ask most clinicians, it's rare that they don't understand, very rare, I hope, that the person in front of them or the person, patients in general, are the reason we're here. Where, at least I try to keep this, is there is such obviously low-hanging fruit that there is no interpretation that's required. If I tell you, hey, you know what? We're not following best practices related to, say, antimicrobial stewardship or pressure injuries or any number of things that we could be working on to improve patient flow, to improve whatever. There is always some standard because, again, most of the time we don't have to create that standard. We can just compare ourselves against that standard, and you can easily circle off, here's the 5 places that we're not doing this. So, again, the analysis is really just a question of understanding what is the actual evidence or best practice, and or even some version of logic. If I just take that, did I inform the patient? And if everybody says to me, no, we actually don't really do anything specifically, here's what I do and here's what I do. And if that's your answer, then we already have the basis of how do we make just a small increment of improvement that's manageable by this team. The nice thing about healthcare providers is they're awfully inquisitive. They actually do want to know things, and they want to learn. And once you get them onto a project, they're dying to know, well, now it's just a competition. Why aren't we moving this score, right? We're already invested in this. We've got day 3 happening. Ah, so their issue is that this was all in gibberish. None of this was all in writing. Nobody wanted to read it. And the 15 patients we had, they said they put it aside and never read it. Okay.
That's what happens to us with papers.
Absolutely. That's what happens with everybody with papers.
Yeah, papers.
I'm adverse to papers.
Me too.
But then what maybe the team decided was, you know what we're going to do? We're going to make this giant, we're going to talk to communications. We're going to make a great infographic poster. Mm-hmm. The combinations of how we change this to make it as efficient as possible but useful, then we go back to the patient and the patient might say, yeah, that's way better, that infographic, because there's no words, it's just pictures, it's universal. Mm-hmm. And it became really clear that what you needed me to do to prevent a fall was to put on my glasses, put on my anti-slippy slippers that you gave me, and I need to hit the call bell. Okay. Those were the 3 things you stuck onto that poster.
I have to interrupt again to make a comment about pamphlets and posters. So often, due to lack of time or resources, these are the kinds of solutions we end up with. And in the right circumstances, they can be helpful, as in the case Lily describes here. But in my experience, they are difficult to do well, often get ignored, and are insufficient to making many of the kinds of changes we really need to fight for, as Lily goes on here to acknowledge.
If all of this was a simple answer, and here's steps 1 to 5, we probably could have done, I say this loosely, that we could have probably done steps 1 to 5. The key is the answer isn't obvious, right? Because it works within the technology that's available in that hospital, in that team. It works within the creativity of that team.
And in the social dynamics of that team.
Absolutely.
How frequently they've ever sort of
communicated
That's right.
together as a collective.
That's right.
It may be that getting everyone in the room for the first time
is a huge step.
Is the first step.
And that's totally fine. And that's where those triads of leadership have to come together to say, what's my diagnostics of this team? What's going to work on this team?
I think what you said about engaging the natural curiosity and also
what matters.
And establishing meaning big time. And that's local. That's extremely localized. Yeah. And then capitalizing, because it seems to me that what you're describing is just basically the process of how we think when we assess patients and families every day.
Yeah.
What is the problem? What are all the parameters and components of this interrelated complex problem?
Yeah.
And what tools do we have to address each of these? And what needs to be maximized? What's possible? What's going to have to be lived with for now?
Yeah. And how do you break it down into workable units? Because you can't fix everything, but it all starts with just an idea. Somebody's idea of how to make something better.
Is that what they mean when they say a learning organization?
A learning organization is one where there's definitely an environment where we foster curiosity instead of blame. So it isn't, you know what, if a bad thing happens or something we didn't want to happen, the learning organization isn't looking for you to blame or that person. It's saying, what about this system has created this issue, and how do we learn from this in a systematic way so that we don't reproduce the same thing, the same outcome, or minimize the chances it's going to happen? So learning organizations are ones that foster a culture of curiosity, ones that foster a culture of a just culture, not one where you're blaming individuals, ones where it's okay to ask a question and work hard to try to find the answer and work intentionally again and work in a way that's intelligent to say, like, I really don't want this to happen again. How do we prevent it?
And try things.
And try things. So, yeah, a learning organization is all of those things, but I guess primarily it's one that's curious and intentionally curious.
Interesting. And so that seems to me that everything we've talked about, from quality to curiosity, collaboration, resources and support from an organization, having leaders with experience like yourself to act as coaches.
Right.
Seems to me that all of those pieces have to kind of be put into place.
Yes, and that then miracle you hope does have to happen.
And is there magic? Do we have magic, Lily?
Yes, then magic happens. Okay, once you've got all those things, I think that's the ingredients for magic. Adding patients and families in the actual design of everything, then you've got super magic.
Okay, well, I'm waiting for the magic, and good luck with that. Well, thank you so much, Lily.
You're welcome. Well, good luck with everything.
Thank you. Hey, congratulations for sitting through a whole conversation on patient engagement and quality improvement. Not always an easy thing to do. But imagine a day when we approach zero. Zero central line infections. Zero incidents of failure to rescue or violence in our workplaces. And if we can reliably provide excellent care in the hospitals, what resources will that free up for investing elsewhere in the system? Can we get there? I don't know. But I'd really like to be part of a group of people who are committed to trying. Like the Registered Nurses Association of Ontario. They're an excellent advocate for and source of information to support healthcare quality improvement. Their Advanced Clinical Practice Fellowship Program is the source of funding to create this season of At the Bedside, along with support from Sinai Health System, who are so lucky to have Lily Yang. A special thank you to the beautiful people of the 14th floor, and thank you for joining me at the bedside. For additional resources, head to the show notes or to atthebedside.ca. You can follow At the Bedside Podcast on Twitter or Instagram. Subscribe wherever you podcast, and please rate, comment, and share. Click all the buttons. Tick all the boxes, like you, as a healthcare provider, have been so thoroughly trained to do. Thank you.